Wow. Here's the first question. How do I massage my humility muscle? How about exercise your humility muscle? On a daily basis, I have been hearing so much about humility. Well, I spent some time doing that, discussing that topic. Just this morning, a very practical way of exercising your humility muscle is try to do something with a spiritual something and see what happens. Try to control your mind. Try to chant attentively and see what happens. You realize that you're dependent on some extra resource besides your own effort to do so. Try anything. I was, during the year that I was GBC chairman, I was saying regularly, this is a service that everyone should have the opportunity to do at least 1 year out of their life. It teaches you to be very humble because the capacity that's required is up here and the capacity that we have is way down here. But it's a service that has to be done, so teaches you to be very humble. When I was a new devotee, Bhakta, in the Boston Temple, I heard this story at least 10 times, and it wasn't until like 15 years later that I heard the same story, Los Angeles version. But the New York version was Brahmananda. You've heard, probably most of you have heard this one before. Brahmananda was one of the leading disciples of Srila Prabhupada. So he was considered a big devotee. And he was also, physical stature was a big devotee. And he was the temple president, and he was in charge of the BBT, or they didn't call it BBT at the time, ISKCON Press, and Prabhupada's personal secretary, and he had all these titles. He was a big devotee. So he was asking Prabhupada, how do I cultivate humility? How do I think of myself in a humble way? And you've heard this. He said, so you should think of Krishna, who is situated in the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan, where the spiritual planet of Krishna is one amongst unlimited numbers of spiritual planets, but it's many, 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 many times bigger than all of the other spiritual planets. And one of the expansions of Krishna is Balaram. And Balaram expands as Sankarshan. And Sankarshan expands as Lord Narayan. And Lord Narayan expands as the second Sankarshan. And that second Sankarshan expands as Mahavishnu, who lies down within the vastness of one corner of the spiritual sky within the Mahatattva. And from the body of Mahavishnu come countless numbers of universes, of which this universe that we're in is but one of countless numbers of universes. In fact, this particular universe is smallest amongst all of the universes, and within that universe there's countless numbers of planets, and amongst those countless numbers of planets there's one earth planet, and on that earth planet there are seven continents, And one of those seven continents is North America. And out of North America, there's the United States. And one of those states is New York State. And within New York State, there's one city called New York City. Within New York City, there's one place called Manhattan. In Manhattan, there are millions of people in so many streets. And right here, standing on Mott Street in Manhattan, you're asking me, how do I consider myself to be humble and insignificant? Just think of Krishna in the spiritual world and your relative position to Krishna, and immediately you'll become very humble. It turns out Prabhupada told Karandar the same thing, the big devotee in Los Angeles who had a similar set of responsibilities. Think of yourself in relation to Krishna, scripturally, or realistically, or 1/10,000th keshagra shatabhagasya, 1/10,000th size, the tip of a hair. How small can you get? We're very tiny. And that's who we are. Think in terms of reality instead of illusion, and it helps to become humble. Oh. Where's Rasika Manjari? Okay. I asked her this question before we came here. Will you consider something, moving, holding, something, the Japa retreat to Thanksgiving weekend next year rather than not having one at all? Well, we've had, in the past, we've had retreats on Thanksgiving weekend when there was some conflict. Largely it was a devotional holiday happening on this weekend. And, of course, then is not now, but then it's much more difficult for children. And because it's more difficult for children, it's more difficult for the parents of those children. And because it's more difficult for the parents of those children, it's more difficult for everybody. That's one consideration, the children. And the aesthetics are not the same, to say the least. You know, you look out the window, you don't see trees. I mean, you don't see leaves. And it's quite cold. You know, the last couple of days at night has been quite cold. That's probably like the warmest it will get during the day. It's cold. Of course, you know, they have heating here. So it's a possibility. It's something that I asked Rasika Manjari to consider and to discuss with Parijata and Dhruva. Is that something that's realistic from the organizer's point of view? And she said, can I get back to you after the retreat? So that's my answer. Get back to you after the retreat. The charm of Gita Nagari isn't the same as Memorial Weekend. It's like the very beginning of the summer season. This time it's just the end of the summer season. Very nice. Aesthetically, November's not as nice. We can still have a program that's indoors instead of outdoors. Oh, another question, same question. As soon as I notice that I am chanting with some attention or feeling, that attentive chanting immediately goes away. Does this mean the feeling or attention is not genuine? And what should I do in this case? doesn't mean that it's not genuine. The feeling or the attention is not genuine. It's just what, according to Madhurya Kadambini, the stage of bhakti, where there's clouds or mist in the sky, or the direct rays of the sun, are... where the direct rays of the sun are not coming through is because they're blocked by the clouds or the mist. So if there's a part in the clouds and the direct rays of the sun come, it's not, doesn't mean that the direct rays of the sun are not taking place, or that the warmth that you feel from the direct rays of the sun is not real. But then when the clouds again form, when the clouds again form, the direct rays are blocked again. So this can't be a man's handwriting. This has got to be a lady's handwriting from this side. Who wrote this one? I thought so. Okay. So it's not that it's disgenuine, but it's, you know, when pride, oh, now I'm, and some pride comes in the heart, that's a cloud will form. And then someone was describing that, Elish was describing that, you know, a little success, a little receiving of some mercy, and then it just slips away because pride enters the heart. So the answer that I gave to him, how to deal with that is see oneself in a humble mood. And if Krishna is giving some mercy, it says, Krishna, how merciful you are, rather than being the enjoyer of that little spiritual success. The being the enjoyer of, that's fruitive tendency. And fruitive tendency is the mode of passion, and it covers the living entity. Avritam jnana etena jnanino nitya vairina. The living entity is forever covered by this all-devouring enemy. Contact with the mode of passion, and passion later is transformed into wrath, frustration. So it's just... it's due to pride entering the heart, and how to overcome pride is to remain humble. And how to remain humble is to be on the spiritual platform, recognize our tininess, in genuine spiritual humility, our tininess. And if Krishna's giving us mercy in this feature or that feature or the other feature, that's up to him. All merciful. Okay. You put your name on it. Why does Lord Krishna only appear in one out of a number of Kali Yugas? Why not every Kali Yuga? Yeah? Why isn't Krishna standing in front of you right now? Why is Krishna not visible before you right now? Yeah. Yeah. So, whatever Krishna does is his causeless mercy. There's no... okay, well, what's the cause of Krishna's causeless mercy? And the answer is, there is no cause of causeless mercy. It's his causeless mercy. There's no cause. So he chooses to appear once in a day of Brahma in his original spiritual form. Now, why doesn't he appear in every Dwarpa Yuga? And then following every Dwarpa Yuga, Lord Chaitanya, and every Kali Yuga. He's so merciful. Why doesn't he appear every Dwarpa Yuga and Kali Yuga? Right? So, it's his own volition. He appears in other features in Dwarpa Yuga, the other 999 in every day of Brahma, and every Kali Yuga, another feature, besides his own personal feature. But it's his special mercy that he appears in his original form as Krishna at the end of the 28th Yuga cycle of Vaivasvata Manu, and following that as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's his special mercy. Okay. When are we scheduled to end? 1:30. What happens at 1:30? Everybody scatters. There's lunch to go or something?
No.
A long one. Maya is very strong. In spite of attempting to take shelter of the instructions, there are a variety of ways for Maya to retaliate as soon as a devotee goes closer and closer to Guru and Krishna. I am fearful of the level of commitment that I foresee for one to follow this path. The commitment goes down to a moment-to-moment basis and hence seems way up there or scary rather than... although I have conviction in the holy name Guru and Shastra. How should one look at falling short of the level of commitment that is required? How should one look at falling short of the level of commitment that is required? Let me guess. a doodle that's on the front of it. Question. So, a couple of things. One's commitment. Prabhupada spoke in these terms. What Krishna is looking to see is not how much we're giving, but how much we're holding back. You've heard that one before. So, let's say a wealthy man gives a dollar and a poor man gives 10 cents. The wealthy man that gives a dollar, it's insignificant. To the poor man, giving 10 cents may be very significant. So what Krishna is looking to see is not whether it's a dollar or 10 cents. Krishna is looking to see what we're holding back. So when you're making commitment... that one of the factors is what's your capacity? And if you hold back to your capacity, then Krishna reciprocates according to what you, the commitment you do make. So in other words, Krishna consciousness is not a binary process. It's not you're on or you're off. You're in or you're out. You win or you lose. It's heaven or it's hell. Not a binary process. It's more like these lights that we have here. They're variable. You can make the lights brighter or dimmer. So a dimmer switch is... according to our surrender unto Krishna, yayatamam prapadyante, tangsitaiva vajam yaham. Krishna reciprocates. So whether you're in Krishna consciousness or out of Krishna consciousness or somewhere in between in Krishna consciousness or out of Krishna consciousness, the principle holds in all circumstances. As you surrender unto Krishna, he reciprocates. So don't worry about falling short of the level of commitment that is required, because you have a certain requirement, you have a certain capacity only, and whatever that capacity is, you offer voluntarily whatever you wish to offer to Krishna. And he'll acknowledge what you offered, the commitment or the sincerity that you offered to him, and he reciprocates. But let's say, here's a second position, your capacity isn't so great and you're making a strong commitment, but that strong commitment isn't enough. So something that you'll learn over time in Krishna consciousness is capacity increases. This is certainly my experience, that there's a certain capacity of service, a certain capacity of surrender, a certain capacity of, like, you know, Krishna likes to keep his sincere devotees in a position where what they need to do, what the opportunity for service that's afforded to them is beyond their capacity. Right, Dhruva? What their opportunity for service is beyond their capacity. So what do you do? Krishna! And you do your best. And as you do, something happens. Your capacity increases. Krishna sends some more resources. And you're not there yet, but you're a lot closer to than when you started. And what does Krishna do? He increases the opportunity and facility for service beyond what you can do. Krishna keeps you always a sincere devotee. Krishna keeps his sincere devotee always in the position where there's more to do than what you can do. The capacity is less than what there's to do. So commitment is, in an ideal sense, you do your best. And whatever your best is, in course of time, increases. And so therefore, a renewing of commitment is necessary. You know, the same level of commitment is necessary now with a greater capacity. So it's gradual, is what I'm indicating here. By Krishna's arrangement, the capacity increases gradually and opportunity to surrender increases over time. So that there's an ongoing commitment making and renewing of commitments over a period of time. So Krishna permits us to do more, and then we have to make a greater commitment to do more or deepen our commitment to him. It's a relationship that's ever increasing. It's dynamic. So don't worry about feeling and my commitment is not sufficient, and with along with that my capacity is not sufficient. You just sincerely I mean, two things. You do the best you can, and the flip side is you recognize your limitations. Don't imitate someone that's has a greater capacity. You do what you can do, because otherwise there's this overcommit and slide back, and then feel bad or guilty or shame or something like that. So do something that you can do and sustain, and then regularly hit the refresh button and see what more you can do or what deeper commitment you can make. Just, it's a relationship. It's not static. It's dynamic. Is that all right, whoever asked that question? Who asked that question? You're okay with that? Okay. 64 round day is excellent. I could do this without any of my usual day-to-day interruptions. But my life in this material world has given me some duties as a father, as a son, as a husband, as an employee. Can I leave all these and do only my only duty as a devotee of the Lord and chant 64 rounds every day? Don't tell your wife. Don't tell your kids either. Don't tell your employer. There's the back door. No. In fact, one of the sharing sessions I was considering to make this remark. That focusing on relationship with Krishna, setting aside other relationships and focusing relationship upon Krishna sounds like, you know, checking out of your family life and checking out of the world. When chanting, focus goes to the relationship with Krishna. And on the strength of that relationship with Krishna, it spiritualizes the relationships with all other relationships. Or a real spiritual relationship is a relationship where Krishna is at the center, not where there's no other relationships. A spiritual relationship is where Krishna is at the center. So how do we make Krishna at the center? When you're with Krishna, chanting Krishna's holy name, your focus goes exclusively to Krishna. Okay, now you go home from the japa retreat where it's not 64 rounds of focusing just upon Krishna. And now I have my family, my boss, my parents, etc. So act in that relationship for Krishna, for the satisfaction of Krishna. And then tomorrow morning when you chant your japa, and the next morning, and the next morning, and the next morning, you're focused on your relationship. You, those things that are external, the time for attending to them is not now. That's, you know, the time for them is later. When you're attending to your chanting of the holy name, you're attending to the chanting of the holy name, because you're with Krishna directly through, you're inviting Krishna, you're calling Krishna. So be present with Krishna. And then you're present with Krishna while you're with your family, and present with Krishna while you're with your employer, and present with Krishna while you're with your other relationships in this world. You put Krishna in the center through the medium of chanting. And because of those other duties, there may not be time for 64 rounds. Most people don't have time for 64 rounds every day. But let the quality, let the principle that you apply be the same. And then when circumstance provides, like Krishna Janmashtami, I know a number of devotees that chanted 64 rounds during Krishna Janmashtami. Many couldn't because they had services they had to do. Some people had to go to work. But some persons chanted 64 rounds on Janmashtami day or on Ekadasi days, sometimes at least increasing. So when opportunity presents itself, increase. But whether it's 8 rounds or 16 rounds or 32 rounds or 24 rounds, chanted 24 rounds, right? Whenever you're chanting, you're with Krishna. Focused. And at this point of, to the exclusion of letting your mind go to what I have to do at work tomorrow or some responsibility that I have to, or something that I, you know, going into the future or going in the past instead of being present. And then when you're doing those other things, you're at work, you're present, but you're with Krishna also. You're doing it for Krishna. That's the art of work. And japa is to help us cultivate or spiritualize the Krishna conscious component of life, of everyday life. Is it okay to chant other gods' names, Ganesh, Mahadev, etc., along with Krishna? And chant all gods' names. So this is a newer devotee, must be, because the answer to the question is, according to Padma Purana, there are 10 offenses against chanting the holy names of the Supreme Lord, and one of those is this one. Specifically, it's the consideration of other names to be equal to or independent from the name of Krishna or Vishnu, or considering they're all one. So they're not equal to the names of Krishna. And when calling Krishna's name, one should not consider equally the calling of other names, and therefore simply take shelter of Krishna's holy name. And by so doing, aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yashami masuchaha, there's no papa, they're not neglecting these elevated personalities. Rather, you're fulfilling the purpose of addressing them simply by addressing Krishna because he's the source of everyone and everything. Okay. Here's an opinion question. What's your opinion of Vedic astrology / the weight or importance to be given to one's astrological chart? Is it true that trying to follow the path of devotional service changes our destiny? The answer to the second one is yes, and the answer to the first one is not very much. Prabhupada was asked, how much weight do we put in astrological charts? Should we check before beginning something? Should we have an astrological chart taken? And Prabhupada said, if you're going to take a journey, you might find out what's the weather forecast and maybe bring an umbrella. You follow? Supposing next year, your family is thinking of coming to Gita Nagari. So they might check the weather forecast. And if so, if it says rain, they might bring an umbrella. Then again, they might not bring an umbrella. So astrological forecast says something about what's coming up, what's the weather forecast, what's it going to be like, what's going to happen. So you may know such and such is by the influence of the stars, such and such circumstances likely to take place. Okay, we know that such and such circumstances likely to take place. But one thing is, devotional service must go on. So, since devotional service must go on, I'll take into consideration such and such circumstance might take place. I may, and I may not, make prior arrangements knowing that such and such may take place. Of course, it may not also. Because that's the second part of the question. Another devotee asked Srila Prabhupada about palmistry. How much importance do we place in palmistry? You know what palmistry is? People look at the lines in your hand and they say, oh, that's your lifeline. You're going to live a long life. You know about palmistry? Different lines represent different influences in your life. One is a health line, another is a lifeline, another is a marriage line, another is an intelligence line. Oh, you've got big intelligence, look at that. Oh, yes. Very important line. So, Prabhupada said, we don't place much importance in palmistry. He said, you go to arti, clap your hands before the deity in arti, and the lines may change. Meaning, your destiny may change just from devotional service. So, we don't place much value. There are some things, just on a practical level, I've grown to appreciate. When there are some things that are relatively unknown and relatively important, like a common way that I take assistance from astrology is in potential marriages. Not always, especially if the persons are known very well, then, you know, don't pay much attention to it. Don't even look. But if there are two persons that aren't so well known, those that are far more experienced in this have told me, that have done lots and lots and lots of work with marriages, the rule that they apply is 30, 30, and 40. 30% what the chart says. 30% she likes him, he likes her. 40% is somebody that knows both parties and has a sense of their disposition. So more weight goes to persons that know both parties and have a sense of what their character is, and is it a good match. Or one individual said, you know, if the chart, because they have these ways of showing, you know, forget it, really good, you know, good, okay, not so okay, forget it. So if there, if somewhere it falls in the not so okay range, or even a little bit, you know, the low side of not so okay, but the other parts are very strong, particularly the two parties that know the individual is very strong, then they said their experiences, they've seen that marriages can work very nicely because that is because, you know, the Krishna consciousness is strong enough that where the differences are, they bring their umbrella. You know, they take care of attending to the needs of the other party, compensating for the needs of the other party because of their commitment to the other person. Because so without commitment to the other person, doesn't matter how good the match is. Okay, that's an opinion answer. Sri Krishna is the creator of this universe. Why did he create evil? And demons. We are all living entities. We all living entities are part and parcel of Krishna. Then why is it so difficult to go back to Godhead? Okay, these two are classics. Who is the author of the classics? Maybe somebody that left? I can put it back in the pile then. Very quickly, Krishna doesn't create evil. Rather, Krishna has part and parcel living entities that are eternally part of him. He doesn't create them, they're eternally part of him, and have qualities like him. One of those qualities is he has unlimited free will, and the tiny living entity has tiny free will. So when that tiny free will is misused, that's called evil. When the tiny free will is properly used, that's called good. So then there's this struggle between good and evil, which is the struggle of the living entity choosing what is favorable to Krishna and what is not favorable to Krishna. We can choose to that which is not pleasing to Krishna. That's called evil. It's misuse of free will. Sad asad yoni janmasu, in the language of Bhagavad Gita. The living entity creates his own good or evil, his own good fortune or ill fortune. And a short answer, there's a nice little story that goes with this, but why is it so difficult to go back to Godhead? And that is, the answer is, because we don't desire sufficiently to go back to Godhead. Our determination is weak. I was just hearing that somewhere. Someone was asking Prabhupada, why is it so difficult? And Prabhupada's answer is, your determination is weak. There's a saying in the Bible, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. Heard that one before? Spirit is willing. So a child in one home program in Tennessee, 6-year-old girl, I asked the same question, why is it difficult? Why can we can't just decide, do a U-turn? We're going this direction. We're just, I don't like it. I want to go back to Krishna. Let's just go back to Krishna. Krishna wants us back. He's inviting us back. We say, yes, I'll just go back. But it's not so easy. Why is it? And it was children's answer time. So one little girl, after like 10 minutes of stuff, one girl said, the soul is saying yes, and the senses are saying, I want to enjoy. And then another boy put his hand up and said, and the mind says, I don't want to give up my independence. There's the answer. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Our determination is weak. Our desire to be with Krishna in the spiritual world is not so strong. Okay. The fruitive, there's a question about the fruitive or the enjoyer mentality. How do we assess periodically if our service is selfish and not in a fruitive or enjoyer mentality? Well, one way is when there's adverse circumstances, where does the mind go? Just watch. So, you know, it's like the answer I'm giving is like Prabhupada's answer to, or his definition of, Dhira. The meaning of Dhira means one who is undisturbed. So Prabhupada's explanation was, when there's not a cause for disturbance, to remain undisturbed is not something exceptional. When there's cause for disturbance and one remains undisturbed, that's exceptional. So to measure one who is Dhira is bring in some disturbance and see what he does. Like that's what Bhrigu did to test Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu. He gave some disturbance. First it was mental, then verbal, then corporeal offense. And when there's provocation to remain unprovoked, that's exceptional. So fruitive mentality is, I'm not getting results, so I quit. Or I'm getting a bad result, or you know, I'm having this problem, or wait a minute, I said I could do this service provided you're this, this, and this, and this, and this are there. But this, and this, and this, if one piece is missing, how do you expect me to do my service? However, when Prabhupada, for example, when Prabhupada came to America, there wasn't anything. And that was not a deterrent for him in his devotional service. There was no fruitive, it was just perform his service. And frankly, he got no result for a whole year. Can you imagine doing something for a whole year and there's no result and you just keep going? Try to grow the garden here in Gita Nagari and nothing comes out of the ground except weeds. Forget it. Or whatever it is that your service is. I mentioned your name without mentioning your name while you were sleeping. Gita Nagari garden. Oh. I won't do it again. I know he's been working so hard. Have you ever been seeing him running around and running around and running around? And running around. Parijata picking him up and saying, come on, Dhruva, a little more. Okay. I am not very clear about the concept of hills and valleys. There's a nice hill over that direction. And we're in a valley. And this is a PhD. You said yesterday to Varsana, his wife, question that the hills or valleys do not matter. What matters is our relationship with Krishna. My question is, what do you mean by valley? For me, sliding down means neglecting the relationship with Krishna. So then, how can I understand what you answered to Varsana, Devidasi? So, I'll try it again. Someone here was describing their chanting was very dry. Who was it that was chanting, saying that? Very dry. 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, Badahari was with us in a japa retreat. And when you think of Badahari, do you think of dry or glub jamun? Glub jamun. I mean, so juicy. Just like bump into him and it's like, you got juice all over you. So, we were staying at the Institute House, one japa retreat, and I was driving down for Mangalarti the next morning, and just asked, how was your chanting? I was very surprised by his reply. He said, dry as a desert. Glob Jamun? Dry as a desert? But immediately, I didn't say that. I was thinking, Brother Hari is, as soon as he begins chanting, it's like, you know, the 40-watt light bulb becomes a 150-watt bulb. He's just like radiant. Isn't it? You've seen. I've seen. Just, wow. And then everybody else just, you know, like, same thing happens. Dry as a desert. And then he said, but it was very nice. So it wasn't all like that. Maybe 60 rounds were like that. He said, but it was very nice. And he said, that's just part of chanting. And then, when we went to the temple room, he led kirtan, and it was, Badahari kirtan. It was so blissful and nectar. That's a valley or a desert, or you hit a dry patch. But relationship with Krishna, no question. He was feeling very satisfied. To pass through whatever he had to pass through, so that his relationship, provided his relationship with Krishna is secure. So he wasn't forgetful of Krishna, just in his case, our case might be different, but in his case, that's the examination that Krishna put him through. Apparently, no reciprocation, silence. No problem. Because his relationship with Krishna is secure, his faith is secure. And the hill can be like, one other question was saying, a little attentiveness, a little receiving of mercy, and then one becomes proud. But one may stay up on that hill for some time. But if it's I'm receiving mercy, but I'm not connecting with Krishna, just like a child taking some candy and forgetting the person who gave the candy or something, then that's a hill or a valley. And what's important is the relationship, not, is it a peak experience or not? All right. The same can be said in terms of our service. There may be periods of time when at State College it's, and then sometimes when it's the opposite. And sometimes when it's like, whoa, what's going on here? And provided that the relationship with Guru and Krishna is intact and strong, it's just, varieties of experience in the course of devotional service. Or for a book distributor, or for, a temple president, or whatever it is that we're doing. Chanting is, a very quick barometer. Okay. Question. Sometimes the prayerful mood in my chanting also becomes mechanical. How to? How do I get deeply convinced that will help me avoid mechanical chanting? Okay, I think I see what they mean. That means that prayer that may also be in a mechanical. So prayer is not just information. Prayer is a mood, and it's an expression coming out of that mood. We had this discussion with Sampath earlier that just take this nice prayer that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote in relation to the fourth Shikshastakam verse, fifth Shikshastakam verse. It's a prayer, but it's expressing, the language is expressing concepts, but his mood is what's being conveyed through the language. His how that Shikshastakam verse 5 has resonated within his heart. So he's offering a prayer. So when reciting standard prayers like that, one thing is like, you know, what the words are and understand what the meaning is, but more importantly is to enter, using Prabhupada's language, to enter into the spirit of the hymn, to enter into the mood of what is being expressed. Let it touch your heart. So if reciting a prayer is also being done mechanical or in a mechanical way, it's not going to have the right effect. It won't have the full effect. But prayer can be more like a meditation than like, you know, information passing. It's a call from the heart. Commonly, devotional prayers particularly. So you practice calling from the heart, practice chanting from the heart, and prayers can help us do that. When receiving mercy, we see new aspiring people who are very favorable. How do we distribute mercy or cultivate Krishna consciousness? How do we distribute mercy to these people or help them cultivate their Krishna consciousness? As a service, like humbly, here's something. The way that Prabhupada described it is that preaching is very natural. When you have something, when you're experiencing something wonderful, it's natural to want to share it with others. That's what preaching really is. So whether it's offer somebody a book, or offer somebody some words, or even just extend some kindness to somebody. I've had several devotees in the past week share how they came to Krishna consciousness, and a big part of it was just how somebody was very kind to them. They didn't like preach to them as much as they showed kindness to them and warmth and were inviting, please take part, please come again, oh how nice to see you. And just from that exchange, they felt, wow, a warm person, some shelter, and continued to come, and are now practicing devotees. Whereas initially, that wasn't the thought they had in their mind at all. It was a curiosity thing or something else. Then, yeah, I think maybe I'd like to make a lifelong commitment to this process. That's not where it started. Okay, two anonymous aspiring Vaishnavis disguised by the artist. Okay. How do you open your heart? Is it the same thing as giving your heart? Well, they're certainly related. If you remember from the loving relationships amongst devotees, that retreat that we had in Gita Nagari, the first class that I gave was, in order to experience a loving relationship, the first thing is to receive. because there are circumstances where there is opportunity or there are opportunities for loving relationships, but our hearts are closed. So the first thing is to receive. Be willing to receive is a start for receiving, because in many cases we don't know what a loving relationship is if we bumped into one, because that's a lot of what the experience has been in the material world. So first is to learn to receive. And is it the same as giving? Well, you can give once you've received. You can't give something that you don't have. You can give something that you have. You can give in reciprocation. And once you have received, then even a complete stranger, you can give if you have received. And that's what devotee relationships are, and what we call conventionally called preaching, or these days you're not supposed to call it preaching, you're supposed to call it outreach. It's not politically correct to call it preaching anymore. So we extend Krishna conscious association to others, and particularly if it can be as simple as anything. Like, you know, here's a samosa, and they don't even know what a samosa is, or whatever it is. And if it's from the heart, it's more meaningful than just, like, you know, zoom, 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 mechanically. What does it mean to open the heart? From the seat of consciousness, accept willingly something that is being extended to you, some kindness or some mercy, and acknowledge it and feel it. And then comes expressing something about it, after whatever it is that you're feeling, expressing gratitude. But it's not just words, it's a feeling of gratitude, even if there's no words. Like what Dhruva Maharaj was feeling upon receiving the mercy of Lord Vishnu, he couldn't even speak. He was in a state of ecstasy where he was stunned. He couldn't speak. But what he was emoting, what he was wishing to convey, Lord Vishnu then gave the ability to speak. So, giving your heart can be just like Rukmini. She gave her heart to Krishna before she wrote that letter to Krishna. So giving your heart to someone is first receiving, or having the capacity to receive a gesture of mercy or kindness. Last retreat in Giranagari, you mentioned that we need to feel the association of the Vaishnavas who wrote the bhajan that we sing. How do you do that? Well, not just the bhajan that you sing, but the scripture that you read, or the purport that you read, or the teaching that you receive. It's not just a teaching like something sterile or a song that's got some information content in it. It's the mood of the person and the gift of the person. The person is giving you something. So in the course of giving that something, they're giving their association. So I mentioned that we need to feel the association of the Vaishnava who wrote the bhajan that we sing. Their personality is being communicated through that expression, to the bhajan. It's not just bhajan, it's any artistic expression. An example that comes to mind is the Radhagovinda temple, or Govindaji temple in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada commented that Rupa Goswami could never do anything small. So when it came to building a temple for Govindaji, it was a 7-story temple. And he designed the architecture himself, and, you know, a masterpiece. I know somebody who was an architect, and they took a group of students from their university, professor of architecture. They took a group of students to go study architecture, and one of the wonders of architecture in India is the Govindaji Temple. They specifically want the university students that didn't know anything about the 6 Goswamis. They wanted to study the architecture of the Govindaji Temple because it's so amazing. And that's Rupa Goswami. It's his expression. He's giving himself through that expression, the architecture of Govindaji Temple and glorification of Govindaji. Whereas the temple of Lokanath Goswami is, you know, very simple, very humble, very meek. It's just his personality. It's just, you know, it's an expression of him. So each thing that a Vaishnava does in service unto Krishna, they're giving themselves in glorification of Krishna. So when we see the something that they've given, if it's a bhajan or whatever it is, you know, the artwork of the artists for Prabhupada's books, you know, they're expressing something of themselves through the medium of that artwork. You're going to take a art class that Dhriti's giving, and you see her artwork, and you see something about her devotion for Krishna. Besides her expertise, her devotion for Krishna comes through. So when you're singing a bhajan, the Vaishnava is giving their devotion to Krishna to you. It's very confidential. They're just disclosing their heart. So appreciate that the point I was making, which you're referring to here, is that you're getting that person's association. You're getting their heart. Confidential feelings disclosed openly. Very intimate association. We're having difficulty understanding what it really means to take shelter of the holy name. Can you explain a little bit? I've been trying. Well, we'll take the shelters that we feel in this world, and then with that understanding, try to understand a little bit the shelters that we may feel for Krishna's holy name. Bhagavatam speaks about the materialistic person who surrounds themselves with fallible soldiers. And those fallible soldiers are their shelter. So their money, their family, their relatives, their house, their position in society, their titles, their car, their status symbols, and those are the shelters of such a person. But they're fallible. In a flickering of a flash of a moment, they're all gone. And they have no shelter. An example that Prabhupada gave is a very wealthy businessman that was one of his acquaintances was diagnosed with having a very serious disease. So he pleaded with the doctor. He said, doctor, you said I have only 6 months. I'll give you any amount of money. Just give me another 3 years. Because, you know, his shelter was his wealth. He could buy his way into anything, but you can't buy a life extension. It's not shelter. There's no shelter there. So there's fallible soldiers or fallible shelters that people regularly construct a world of, you know, their little kingdom that has this little shelter thing, supposedly, that meant to protect them and give them happiness. It does neither. So if those are fallible shelters, then whoops. If those are fallible shelters, then is there such a thing as real shelter? If there's a tendency to take shelter, there must be real shelter. What's real shelter? And what does it mean to have shelter? A place where you're safe. A place where anything can happen and it's okay. Because you have shelter. Because the other things are not shelter. The other things are, you may be acting in relationship with them in some form or fashion in service to Krishna. And if those things are taken away, it's okay. Because you have your constitutional shelter. You can always chant. And even if you like lose your vocal cords, you can chant in your mind. As long as you don't lose your mind. Pray to Krishna. That's your shelter. The soul's natural shelter is Krishna. And he makes his shelter, makes himself available through his name. So that's what it means. You've heard the expression, home is where the heart is. Heard that before. So, where the heart is, that's where your shelter is. What time are we supposed to end? 1:30. We hear about the precarious position that we are in as conditioned souls. But how do we really feel the danger so that we can realize the urgency and deepen our dependency on the holy name? Well, one way to feel the danger is, what's the word? Slam? Yeah. Get slammed. You can feel the danger. Like, you know, in Leicester, UK, the morning of Vyasa Puja, there was an explosion in the kitchen. Fortunately, it didn't happen on Janmashtami day. It happened the next morning. But a propane gas cylinder exploded in the kitchen. The roof went flying into the air, and the whole building burst into flames. Just happened. So that's one way to feel impending danger, is when it comes crashing down. Or in New Zealand, the day after Vyasa Puja, there was a major earthquake. And we have a temple in Brisbane. No, that's Australia. Somewhere over there. We have a temple. And, you know, the altar was shaking and the deities were literally dancing on the stage, on the altar. And it was really, really early hours of the morning, so the devotees were enough present to secure the deities, take them off the altar, and, you know, the rest of the building wasn't damaged. But A similar thing happened years ago in Los Angeles. There was an earthquake and Lord Jagannath fell off the altar and the deity broke. You know, there were devotees on the altar and they grabbed hold of the other deities after Jagannath fell. But, you know, now they secured the deities, bolted them to the altar, and they replaced Lord Jagannath. So when some calamity happens, it's like strikes, then you can feel danger. But the reality is, whether it's, even if it's not happening at this moment, the capacity for danger to take place at any moment is there. And for someone to think otherwise is a fool's paradise. This material circumstance that we have is so fragile. This body is so complex. Study medicine. And, you know, the complexity is ridiculous. And a little something, and the whole machine can break down. Or some part of it can just like be in such an enormous pain. A little something. And there's so many little somethings. So complex. Far more complex than an automobile or some, you know, other little machine. It's extremely complex. And, you know, that's the place of happiness for us, is this body. Whew. That's a bad program. So there's danger, padam, padam, yanvi, padam. There's danger at every moment. So where's our shelter? You know, we're going along just like dependent upon this very complex machine. And a little something happens and it's gone. The whole thing is gone. Gone. And then what are we left with? It depends on where your shelter is. Better practice taking shelter, because the whole thing is going to be gone. You sometimes see older people walking up the stairs very slowly. And you may think, it's not going to happen to me. Watch, boom, 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 at the top of the steps. If you live that long, if death doesn't come before then, it'll happen. So the youthful vitality is gone. And then, you know, then you can't jump up the stairs anymore. You gotta, you know. It's just, you look around and it's easy to see. The leaves are just starting to turn. The trees over here, they're turning to fall color already. And it's only a matter of time. When the wind was blowing yesterday, all the trees, you know, those dark turning leaves are just flying all over the place. And in a little while, it's all going to be barren. And just watch what's going on, and you see, whatever comes into being, it has its states of transformation, like us. So whatever it is that's, like, secure, it's ridiculous. It's not secure. Nothing. And what's a life where nothing is secure? It's very fearful. It's hollow. It's a sham. It's a pretense. It's a cheat. There's no shelter. Whoa! Is that really what's going on? Is there no real shelter? There is real shelter. But it's impetus to take real shelter in something that's not impermanent. It takes being a little thoughtful. But when we're very, very busy being enjoyers, we're not so thoughtful, we're just busy being enjoyers. You know, eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow, whatever happens. But mode of goodness is a place of thoughtfulness where one considers what's happening. particularly in with the assistance of Scripture to guide us. Okay, we're not going to be able to finish all these. Okay. Some of these questions are duplicates. How do I approach devotionally instead of my IT approach to thinking? Your servant, Sampat. Where is Sampat? Oh, there we go, okay. What is the next steps that I can take while looking for Krishna's mercy? Well, take the things that you heard and apply them little by little by little by little. So just take one thing. Take this nice prayer. It's very devotional. And the instruction is enter into the spirit or the mood of the prayer. And take that instruction and work with it. And after entering into the mood or like resonating with, it goes into your heart, then chant. And let that mood come out through the course of your chanting. Just start with something simple like that. With your deities in your home, do something that's so simple, the only real substance behind it is the devotion. Like, offer some prasadam, or sing a prayer, recite a prayer, or offer something. Or, you know, just standard prayer or just your own spontaneous prayer for the pleasure of the... It's a devotional expression. So take, you know, one or two very simple things and just enter into the spirit of that. Okay. Okay. What's the best way to show gratitude? It depends on the person that you're showing gratitude to. It should be appropriate, time, place, and circumstance. That's called culture, where as appropriate you express. So without more detail, can't go further. I've heard that when you chant, the things that come to your mind are your attachments. Sometimes I think of devotees that I like a lot. Does that mean that my attachment is material? No. You can have spiritual attachments as well as material attachments. It's not just that when you chant, your mind goes to what you're attached to. Like, in general, the mind goes to what you're attached to. Krishna Chaitanya is attached to a little paper airplane right now, so... But if he... because of nice training, you know, he was second in the line to get his little thread on his wrist, because, you know, there's some appreciation. He's the number one when it comes to Mahaprasadam. Not number two, number one. So it's, attachments can be spiritual also. But it doesn't, it's not just dependent upon when you're chanting. Okay, we're at 1:30 and the bell's ringing. So we're going to end. Thank you all for coming to Gita Nagari. And we'll see what happens next year. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.